This is The Health Show, a presentation of National Productions.
When a condition affects about a third of the population, you'd think it would be getting a lot of attention. But half the people in the U.S. with hypertension or high blood pressure are not doing enough to control their pressure.
So giving the new drug to everybody is not the answer to the problem. You have to give the new drug to the person whose hypertension is responsive to that drug.
On today's Health Show, we'll learn more about the problem and find out what can and should be done.
We'll also hear from an artist who survived breast cancer and wanted to do more to help than just wear a pink ribbon. You'll be surprised when you hear just what she is wearing. I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Health Show. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, about 67 million Americans have hypertension, and 36 million of them do not have their blood pressure under control. You want more numbers? We've got them. About 1,000 people a day die because of hypertension, and the annual cost of the healthcare system is about $131 billion. In his new book, Hypertension and You, Old Drugs and the Right Drugs for Your High Blood Pressure, Dr. Samuel Mann says that one of the main problems is that people are being prescribed the wrong medications for their hypertension. Dr. Mann is a nationally known hypertension specialist and professor of clinical medicine at New York Presbyterian Hospital, Weill Cornell Medical Center. We spoke recently, and he said that the test we do for high blood pressure really isn't that accurate.
Yeah, it's actually amazing when you think of how many sources of error there are in the measurement of the blood pressure. And of course, we're using the same gadget we used 50 years ago. But it's not just the inaccuracy of the gadget, it's the other errors in using it. And very important, if the busy doctor doesn't give the patient 5 minutes to sit quietly, you're going to have an elevation of 10, 20, even 20 millimeters. If the patient is chatting when you measure the pressure, again, 5, 10 millimeters, and 10 millimeters affects decisions as far as increasing medication. And this happens very frequently. When I ask my patients if the other doctors who measure their pressure allow them the 5 minutes, it's very frequent that they don't.
Now, does this have more to do with maybe a patient was rushing through traffic to make the appointment, or is it the old white coat fever thing?
Well, those are two different answers. The rushing through traffic is one reason why they should be asked to wait for 5 minutes to settle down. The white coat problem, even if they wait a half hour, their pressure will still be up when the doctor comes in to check it. Interestingly, the pressure in people who experience the white coat phenomenon, meaning their pressure goes up when the doctor comes in to check it, measurement by the nurse may be a more accurate measurement because there's less of that reaction with a nurse than with the doctor. But the white coat phenomenon of the pressure going up with the doctor, that you cannot eliminate by waiting 10 minutes. That's going to persist.
I once had a doctor tell me, you know, Bob, life is a series of white coats, so we should take that seriously.
That's a logical thing to say, although studies show that the degree of blood pressure elevation that one experiences in response to a doctor does not correlate with how much our blood pressure goes up with day-to-day stress. They don't correlate with each other, and they don't predict each other.
A lot of what you talk about, too, is the new drugs that are being prescribed for blood pressure medication that aren't doing the job or at least aren't being prescribed correctly.
Whether it's old drugs or new drugs, there are some excellent ones and others that are not so good. And a lot of that is about its details about the drugs. And there are so many drugs out there and so many details to know that non-specialists aren't aware of a lot of those details. Some of the new drugs are excellent drugs, but we have to keep in mind that everybody's hypertension is different. So if drug A works for this person, another person, drug A, might do nothing. They need a different drug. So giving the new drug to everybody is not the answer to the problem. You have to give the new drug to the person whose hypertension is responsive to that drug. Somebody else might do better with one of the older drugs. One of the important older drug classes is the diuretics. And what is very clear in hypertension studies is that there are many people whose pressure will never be under control without enough of a diuretic, no matter how many of the newer drugs they're given and whether they are good drugs or bad drugs. In those people without a diuretic or without enough of a diuretic, they will never achieve blood pressure control.
Speaking of finding the proper drug for the proper patient, is it just trial or error, or is there an easier way to hone in on the right drug?
That's the big question, and the answer is yes, there is a way to hone in, not with 100% accuracy, but to greatly improve the odds of picking the right drug, and I talk about that in the book. There are a few main mechanisms that drive blood pressure, such as retention of fluid and of volume and sodium, such as the hormonal system called the renin-angiotensin system, which is renin is secreted by the kidneys, which play a central role. And then the other mechanism is the brain, the sympathetic nervous system. And if you can follow the clues that can tell you which is the more likely mechanism, you can pick the right drug rather than trial and error. So I'll give you an example. If you have an elderly black gentleman, we know the diuretics work better. With older age, the diuretics work better. If I have a patient who is a 78-year-old black male, I'm more likely to pick a diuretic than one of the new ACE inhibitors or angiotensin antagonists. It will work better. That's just one clue, and there are many others. As far as, do we want to use a drug like a diuretic? Do we want to use a drug like an ACE inhibitor? Or do we want to use drugs that target the sympathetic nervous system?
Is part of the problem that just doctors like using what's new, and, well, that's been around for so long, you know, say a diuretic's been around for so long, we must have something better than that by now?
Certainly, doctors are affected by the detail men who are constantly promoting the new drugs. They're also affected by the studies in the literature. They look at the new drugs, they ignore the old drugs, because it's the new drugs that money is available to do the studies, to sponsor studies. So a doctor sees the literature, reads all about the new drugs, the old drugs aren't there. So the new drugs have that advantage, and they are, I believe, overused. And there are some older drugs that are wonderful that many doctors don't even know the name of because they're just not talked about. And that's what the book talks about, is some of the older drugs that are very well tolerated and very effective, but not widely prescribed.
You also talk in the book about psychological factors that might have a lot to do with how somebody reacts to a different medication.
I think it's very important. I think I could talk about this for an hour. I'll try to keep it very, very brief. There's a common misconception among patients and among doctors that stress and anxiety and anger cause hypertension. And I have a chapter devoted to this psychological component of hypertension. There's no doubt that stress and anger and anxiety raise our blood pressure in the moment. That's not hypertension. Anxiety and anger will raise everybody's pressure in the moment. Some people are more anxious, and if they come into the doctor's office and they're anxious, one will get a high reading, and that makes us think they have sustained hypertension, when in fact, as soon as they walk out of the doctor's office, the pressure's down. They've been trying to prove for 50 years that anger and anxiety lead to development of hypertension. They haven't proven it, and I don't believe it's true. I do think that psychological factors are involved, and particularly in patients who don't respond to the usual drugs like the diuretics and the ACE inhibitors. And there is a mind-body connection. I believe in about 10% of patients, although in those with severe hypertension or unresponsive hypertension, the proportion is much higher. So I think there definitely is a mind-body connection, but the day-to-day anger and stress do not lead to sustained hypertension as a result of looking at thousands of studies that have tried to prove that they do.
You talk also in the book about beta blockers and how are they being used incorrectly, or are they just something that we should just go beyond?
You can get a lot of different opinions. I think a common opinion would be that they are overused. Now, the beta blockers can lower blood pressure by two mechanisms. One, they block the secretion of the kidney hormone renin, and that does lower blood pressure. The other is they slow the heart rate and cardiac output down. The problem with the beta blockers is side effects. They make people tired. They make people less interested in getting up and exercising. They make people's hands and feet feel cold. They can affect the sugar metabolism that can contribute to development of diabetes. They have all those side effects. And I think the fatigue is a big one. And a lot of patients don't even realize it until I stop the beta blocker and they feel better. So if I want to block that hormone renin instead of using a beta blocker, I'll use an ACE inhibitor, which doesn't cause fatigue. So for hypertension, and it's pretty generally agreed, a beta blocker usually is not a good first choice for the first drug to treat hypertension because of the side effects. On the other hand, if I have a patient who is wired and has a rapid heart rate and a beta blocker slows them down a little bit, they actually feel better and it helps their blood pressure. So for that kind of patient, a beta blocker is a beautiful fit. But for most patients, and a lot of the patients I see, there's no reason for them to be on the beta blocker and no reason for them to tolerate years of fatigue on a beta blocker.
It seems like such a balancing act between controlling the hypertension and managing the side effects.
Every drug has a list of side effects. The good news, there are a lot of drugs that usually don't have side effects, and when we focus on them, we can control hypertension in almost anybody without side effects by trying not to use the drugs with the most side effects. And if there are side effects, there are always drugs that we can switch to. There are dozens and dozens of drugs. And if I have a patient who's having side effects, I mean, my instruction to the patient is side effects generally are not acceptable. If you have a side effect, you tell me, I'll change your medicine. I will not ask you to live with side effects for years.
If you are put on blood pressure medication, is that it for life? Are you on those meds for life, or are there other things that can be done to get rid of your hypertension?
A lot of patients are concerned about starting medicine for exactly that reason. Once on medicine, always on medicine. Is that true or not? Usually it is true if, in fact, you need the medication. If a patient comes in and his blood pressure was elevated once or twice, I don't start medicine because everybody's pressure can vary, and I want to be convinced that their blood pressure is elevated in a sustained way before I commit them to medication. But if I see a patient whose blood pressure was elevated once and his doctor started medication, I will often stop it and let's look at the blood pressure without the medicine. Now, let's say one has sustained hypertension. Can you get off medicine? Yes. If you lose weight, if you exercise more, if you reduce salt intake, all those can lower blood pressure. And my book is not about diet and exercise and non-drug therapy, not because that's not important, but because many, many books talk about that. I have nothing new to say. It's all true. Weight loss in obese patients, reducing salt, increasing exercise, yes, they can help reduce medication and in some cases get off medication entirely.
Okay, and it sounds like, you know, the old standby, communication between doctor and patient is most important to getting this where you want it to be.
Absolutely. You know, a doctor should answer the patient's questions. And if you don't feel well on a medication, the doctor should be responsive to that and change the medication. And it's rare that a doctor would have to say, well, I realize you have that side effect, but we have no alternative. We'll have to live with it. That's rare, and that's not acceptable.
And not only does the doctor have to answer the patients have to remember to ask the questions.
Right. And a typical example of that is some patients develop a dry cough from an ACE inhibitor, and if they never mention it to the doctor, the doctor can't make the simple change in medication to eliminate the cough. If you have any side effects that you think are a result of the medication, one has to tell the doctor, and then he can judge, is that from the medication or not?
Dr. Samuel Mann is a professor of clinical medicine at New York Presbyterian Hospital Weill Cornell Medical Center. His book is called Hypertension and You, Old Drugs and the Right Drugs for Your High Blood Pressure.
Still to come, a breast cancer survivor turns her tumor into art. We'll explain next on The Health Show.
You can find The Health Show anytime online at healthshow.org. Search the archive and listen to whole programs you may have missed or would like to hear again. Even subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. You can also follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow.
You can start your own Health Show archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for Health Show number 1278.
This is The Health Show. I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs. The pink ribbon has been an incredibly successful piece of marketing for breast cancer research. For cancer survivor Leonore Caraballo, on the other hand, it's supremely annoying. She always hated the color pink. She wanted to come up with a symbol that she found more empowering. Caraballo is a new media artist who collaborates with her husband, Abu Farman, under the name Caraballo Farman. The couple started making bronze models of real tumors, created from MRI scans that you can wear around your neck or put on your desk. Independent producer Eric Malinsky reports that this artwork is creating quite a buzz among cancer researchers.
In 2008, Leonore Caraballo was diagnosed with breast cancer. From the moment the doctor said the word cancer, everything was a blur.
I realized a year later, after I went through the whole cancer management, that I had no idea what they were talking about. I hadn't seen this tumor. I knew it wanted to kill me, but I didn't really understand what it meant.
Now, Leonore is an artist. She needs to process things visually. So she asked the radiologist to give her pictures of the MRI scans. Each scan is a different cross-section of the tumor, like a slice of cake.
You know, there's thousands of slices. So I just looked at each and every one, different angles. And I kept on wanting to see it. I wanted to see it as an object. I wanted to take it basically out of the breast. I wanted to do what the surgeon did with the double mastectomy. I wanted to do that artistically.
She wanted to build a 3D model of her tumor, something she could hold in her hands. The first step was to create a 3D model on the computer, and then a 3D printer would take that blueprint and build a plastic model. It wasn't easy.
The MRI image is everything, right? So all the tissue, all the vessels, and the tumor is kind of there with a slightly different shading.
Abu Farman is Leonore's husband and creative partner.
The 3D printer can't print everything. First of all, it'll just go nuts. So it either do surface.
And it would take 3 months to
print. We don't want to just print the surface of a breast. So the first thing was, digitally, how do you just isolate that thing?
And once they isolated that thing in the computer, the 3D printer was like, I can't print this thing. I mean, you know, if the printer could talk. The tumor was a weird blobby shape with very thin tentacles shooting outward. The artist had to work very closely with a computer technician.
We were, you know, in a way using this extremely high-tech process and then taking it all the way back to
the Bronze Age.
Back to the Bronze
Age. Lost wax and Bronze Age.
Actually, they took it to a foundry in Queens where the plastic model was cast in bronze. Now Leonore wears a little bronze tumor around her neck.
For me, it's a reminder that I hate the word survivor, but that I'm here and this thing is out of my body. And, you know, and I feel more powerful than it.
It means it stopped growing. Okay, that's how it was. That's the final
form
it
took. That's how it was removed, and it's its final form it took, and it's not going to move anymore. It's not going to spread.
But they wanted to make more. So Michelle Drotman, a radiologist at Cornell Medical Center, gave them MRI scans of tumors from different women.
It's just amazing how different it looks outside the breast.
And how different the tumors look from each other. Some look like rock candy, others look like a piece of coral or a meteorite.
And that's what cancers usually are. They're not these nice, smooth, lesions. They're ugly.
They're aggressive by nature.
Cancers don't follow tissue planes like benign things, which kind of respect the tissue. Tumors just grow, you know, wherever they want.
The couple created a company called Object Breast Cancer. Women can order paperweights, amulets, or worry beads based on their own MRI scans. Or they can order sculptures based on tumors from anonymous women. One of their first customers was Paula de la Cruz. She still cringes when she thinks about the moment the nurse gave her the results.
She handed me the paper and she said, "Oh, I'm so sorry for the bad news." I'm like, what am I supposed to do? I have no idea.
She turned to her friend, Leonor Carabello, who recommended a surgeon and a radiologist. And then eventually, Leonor sculpted a paperweight based on Paula's tumor. Now Paula's in remission, but she likes having a physical reminder that sits on a stack of bills.
When I was going through the whole healing process, you know, chemotherapy, etc., you know, people use this war, you know, tones like, you gotta beat this, blah, blah. And I always felt it's my body that's chaotic and that's making these cells that are out of control. I mean, how are you at war with your own body?
You're monumentalizing illness.
I talked with the art critic Patty Johnson. She's a blogger who writes for Art Review and Art in America.
I think if you believe that, like, making this thing into a solid object that doesn't move is going to empower you, then obviously, yes, it is empowering. Would I feel that way? No.
Artwork that deals with illness, like AIDS or cancer, can put critics in a very difficult position.
I feel like I'm being a jerk right now, and that doesn't feel good. I mean, you asked me to talk about, like, to bring my background and my knowledge to this, and so that's what I have to do. It's part of my job.
Now, typically, art that deals with illness is fairly abstract. Now, this work is painstakingly literal, which is why Patty Johnson doesn't like it.
From a fine art perspective, we would look at the narrative that this work produces, and we would look at the metaphors, and we would say, you know, these metaphors are really obvious. They're a little too concrete. You know, I do wish that it looked a little more dangerous, something that looked otherworldly and a little less like things we already know.
Like a piece of coral or a rock formation.
Then it falls into another genre of art that I like to call invisible history art. So that's when the object doesn't speak to you until you're aware of the backstory.
But that backstory made the sculptures really interesting for Dr. Alexander Swistel. He removed the tumors from Leonor Carabello and Paula de la Cruz. And then suddenly there they were, scaled up, cast in bronze, and sitting in an art gallery.
To actually see it in front of you, and then to actually pick up the sculpture and run your fingers over it and just understand, this is something that I took out. As a surgeon, it was a huge surprise.
Remember the tentacles in the tumors that made it so hard for the artist to build 3D models? Well, in real life, they were misleading Dr. Swistel. They were making him think that the tumors were actually bigger than they were.
We kind of thought to ourselves, well, wait a minute. So maybe we've been going at the treatment all wrong.
So as part of an experiment, he's working with a radiologist, Michelle Drotman, to create 3D models of tumors in the computer, just like the artists. The doctors are going to decide how much radiation to give patients based on the volume of their tumors, not just the widest dimensions.
Making therapeutic decisions based on three-dimensional volume measurements has just never been, to my knowledge, done at all in any kind of setting of any kind of tumor, but certainly for breast cancer.
And clinical trials are underway. He predicts that some of his patients may end up getting less chemotherapy, and maybe none at all.
That report from independent producer Eric Malinsky. That's all the time we have for this week's Health Show. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at healthshow.org. You can explore the archive for any programs you might have missed or would like to hear again. You can also subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org.
Want more? Then follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is letters@healthshow.org.
I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
Stay healthy and be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Health Show.
Dr. Nina Sachs is a practicing member of the American College of Gastroenterology. Bob Barrett is producer of The Health Show. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Health Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.